of the busy Theban quay. The harvest was still many days off, and most of the farmers had little to do but wait for ripening. So the stalls were clogged with country folk who had nothing much to trade except time. Merritt exchanged a beaded necklace from one of her mother's for some sweet cake, and we ate as we wandered, arm in arm, from one stall to the next. I marveled at the amount of jewelry for sale and wondered who could afford so many baubles. I saw sandal makers turning out cheap shoes made to order. A line of men waited for one particular barber, known to have the best gossip. I averted my eyes from a pile of Canaanite woolens, which might have been woven by my own aunts. Merritt and I laughed over the antics of a monkey, who held a brace of tall, hungry-looking dogs on leads and made them beg for scraps of food. After we had taken in the sights, my friend said it was time to start our hunt. But the first basket maker we came upon had nothing large enough to suit my needs. So we walked on, passing the wine and oil merchants, bakers, and men selling live birds. We saw many beautiful things, too. Incised Kushite pottery, hammered bronze vases, household gods and goddesses, three-legged stools and chairs. My eye fell upon a handsome box with an inlaid cover that bloomed with a garden made of ivory and faience and mother-of-pearl. "Now there's a piece for the master's tomb," said Merritt, in honest admiration. The carpenter appeared behind his work and began to tell the story of its making, where he purchased the acacia wood, and how much difficulty he had in applying the ivory. He spoke thoughtfully and slowly, as though he were telling a story rather than trying to make a sale. I kept my eyes on the box as he spoke, hearing only the warmth of his voice, and staring at his hands as they traced the design upon his handiwork. Merritt started teasing the fellow. "What do you take us for, knave?" she asked. "Do you think we are rich ladies disguised as midwives? Who but a rich man could afford anything so fine as this? Who could lay claim to such a work of art except the king's own tomb-maker?" "You are pulling my leg, little man," she said. He laughed at her words and replied, "If you think me little, you must come from a land of giants, sister." "I am Benia," he introduced himself, "and you might be surprised at the bargains available at my stall." "It all depends upon the buyer, my dear," he teased back. "Beautiful women always get what they want." At this, Merritt howled with laughter and poked me in the ribs, but I said nothing, for I knew that his words had been aimed at me. In an instant, Merritt, too, understood that the carpenter had been talking to me, and although I had not said a word, the sound of his voice and the gentleness of his words had moved me. My fingers, almost of their own accord, traced the pattern of a milky white leaf that was inlaid upon the box. "This comes from the heart of a sea creature that lives far to the north," Benia said, pointing to another part of the design. I noticed the size of his hands. His fingers were thick as the branches on a young fruit tree, and even longer than his massive palms, which hard work had gnarled into mountains and valleys of muscle. He caught me staring, and drew his hand away as if in shame. "When I was born, my mother took one look at me and cried out when she saw these," Benia said. "They were far too large for my body, even then. 'A sculptor,' she said to my father, who apprenticed me to the finest stonecutter. But I had no talent for stone. The alabaster cracked when I so much as looked at it, and even granite would not permit me to approach. Only wood understood my hands. Supple and warm and alive, wood speaks to me and tells me where to cut, how to shape it. I love my work, lady." He looked into my eyes, which I had raised to his face as he spoke. Merritt saw the look pass between us and leaped into the silence like a shrewd fishwife. "This is Diener, tradesman, a widow, and the finest midwife in Thebes. We come to the market in search of a simple basket to hold payment from her grateful mothers." "But a basket will not do for a master," said Benia, turning to bargain with Merritt. Let me see what you brought to trade, Mother, for I have been sitting here all day without luck. Merritt unpacked our collection of trinkets, a carved slate for mixing malachite into green eyeshadow, a large carnelian scarab, too red for my stomach, and a beautiful beaded head covering, the gift of a pretty young concubine who gave birth to a fine little boy she handed directly to her mistress without even looking at the baby. Merritt and I saw many strange things in the birthing rooms at Thebes. Benia feigned interest in the scarab. "For your wife?" Merritt asked, without pretense at subtlety. "No wife," Benia replied simply. "I live in my sister's house, and have these many years. But her husband is impatient of my place at his table. Soon I will be leaving the city to live among the workmen in the Valley of the Kings," he said slowly, speaking again to me. At this, Merritt grew excited on her own behalf and told him all about her sons, who were bakers employed for the workmen there. "When I go, I will seek them out," Benia promised, and added, "I will be given my own house there, as befits a master craftsman. 4 rooms for myself only," he said, as though he could hear his own voice echoing through the empty chambers already. "What a waste, carpenter," Merritt replied. As the two of them exchanged these confidences for my benefit, my fingers followed the edges of the pond that Benia had fashioned on the box cover. Before I could draw away, he covered my hand with his own. I was afraid to look into his face. Perhaps he was leering. Perhaps he thought by making this absurd transaction, trading a pretty bauble for a masterwork, I then would owe him the use of my body. But when Merritt jabbed me in the ribs to answer, I saw only kindness on the carpenter's face. "Bring the box to the garden door at the house of Noctre, scribe to the priests of Amun-Re," Merritt said. "Bring it tomorrow." She handed over the scarab. "Tomorrow, in the morning," he said, and we left. "Now that was a good transaction, girl," said Merritt, "and that scarab was a lucky piece to buy you a treasure box and a husband, too." I shook my head at my friend and smiled as though she were babbling, but I did not say no. I said nothing at all. I was embarrassed and thrilled. I felt an unfamiliar tightness between my legs, and my cheeks were flushed. And yet, I did not fully understand my own heart, for this was nothing like what I felt when I first saw Shalem. No hot wind blew through Benia and into me. This feeling was much cooler and calmer. Even so, my heart beat faster, and I knew my eyes were brighter than they had been earlier in the day. Benia and I had exchanged a few words and brushed against each other's fingers. And yet, I felt connected to this stranger. I had no doubt that he felt the same. All the way home, my step beat the rhythm of my wonder. How can this be? How can this be? As we approached Noctre's house, Merritt broke an unaccustomed silence and laughed, saying, "I'll deliver your babies yet. By my count, you are not yet 30 years in this world. I'll see grandbabies through you, daughter of my heart." And she kissed me goodbye. But once I walked into the garden, all thoughts of Benia were banished. The house was in an uproar. Ramos was back. He had arrived soon after I had left. The servants had been sent to search for me, and since I never left the grounds without informing Raynefer first, she had grown alarmed and even sent word to her friend Rudedit. When my mother-in-law saw me enter the yard carrying a half-eaten cake from the market, she grew angry and turned on her heel without speaking. It was the cook who told me to hurry and see my son, who had come home to recover. "Recover?" I asked her, suddenly cold with fear. "Has he been ill?" "Oh, no," she said with a broad grin. "He comes home to heal from the circumcision and to celebrate his manhood in high style. I'll be working from dawn till midnight all this week," she said, and pinched my cheek. I heard nothing past the word circumcision. My head rang and my heart pounded as I rushed into the great hall where Ramos was arrayed on a litter near Noctre's chair. He looked up at me and smiled easily, without a trace of pain in his face, which was now a different face altogether. It had been nearly 5 years since he left me, and the little boy was now a young man. His hair, no longer shaved, had grown in thick and black. His arms showed muscle. His legs were no longer silky smooth, and his chest bespoke his father's beauty. "Ma," said the young man who was my son. "Oh, Ma, you look well, even better than I remembered." He was merely being polite. He was a prince of Egypt, addressing the serving woman who had given him birth. It was just as I feared. We were strangers, and our lives would never permit us to become more than that. He motioned for me to come and sit beside him, and Noctre smiled his approval. I asked if he suffered, and he waved the question away. "I have no pain," he said. "They give you wine laced with the juice of poppies before they draw the knife, and afterward, too," he said. "But that all happened a week ago, and I am quite recovered. Now it is time to celebrate, and I am home for the banquet." "But how are you, Ma?" he said. "I am told you are a famous midwife now, that you are the only one the great ladies of Thebes will trust when called to childbed." "I serve as I can," I said quietly, and turned his question aside. For what can a woman tell a man about babies and blood? "But you, son, tell me what you learned. Tell me of your years in school and of the friendships and honors you earned, for your uncle says you were the best of your fellows." A cloud passed over Ramos's face, and I recognized the little boy who burst into tears when he found a dead baby duck in the garden. But my son did not speak of the taunts of his schoolmates, nor recount for me the mocking cries that followed him everywhere during the first year of his studies. "Where is your father? You have no father." Ramos did not speak of his loneliness, which grew as he proved himself the best of his class, and the teacher took note of him and made him the favorite. He spoke only of his teacher, Carr, whom he loved and obeyed in all things, and who doted upon him. Unlike other masters, he never beat his students or berated them for their mistakes. "He is the most noble man I ever met, apart from Uncle," said Ramos, taking Noctre's hand in his. "I am home to celebrate not only my coming of age, but the great gift Carr has given me. My teacher asks that I accompany him south to Kush, where the trade in ebony and ivory has been revived, and where the vizier was caught embezzling from the king. The king himself has asked Carr to go and oversee the installation of a new overseer, and to take stock and report upon what he finds there. I will go to assist my teacher, and watch when he sits as judge and the people bring their disputes before him." Ramos paused so I would hear the importance of his next words. "I am instructed to learn the duties of a vizier. After this journey, my training will be complete, and I will receive my own commission and begin to earn honor for my family." "My uncle is pleased, Mother. Are you pleased as well?" The question was sincere, echoing the longing of a boy who asks his mother to pronounce upon his achievement. "I am pleased, my son. You are a fine man who will do honor to this house. I wish you happiness, a kind wife, and many children. I am proud of you, and proud to be your mother." That was all I could say. Just as he did not tell me of the pain he suffered at school, I did not speak of how much I missed him, or how empty my heart had been, or how he had taken the light from my life when he left. I looked into his eyes, and he returned my gaze fondly. He patted my hand and lifted it to his lips. My heart beat to the twin drums of happiness and loneliness. 2 nights later, I watched Ramos from across the room at the feast given in his honor. He sat beside Noctre and ate like a boy who had not been fed for a week. He drank of the wine, and his eyes glittered with excitement. I drank wine too, and stared at my son, wondering at the life he would live, amazed that he was a man already, only a few years younger than his father had been when I saw him for the first time in his father's house. Poised on the edge of manhood, Ramos was half a head taller than Noctre, clear-eyed and straight as a tree. Renefra and I sat side by side for the first time in years and admired the man-child who had given us both a reason to live. My hand brushed hers, and she did not withdraw from my touch, but held my fingers in hers. And for a moment at least, we shared our love for our son, and through him, for the unnamed son and husband of Shechem. A pretty serving girl raised her eyes to him, and he flirted back. I laughed to think of the baby whose bottom I had washed now warming to a woman. My face ached from smiling, and yet my sighs were so loud that Raynefer once turned to ask if I was in any pain. It was the finest banquet I had ever seen, with much of noble Thebes in attendance. The flowers shone in the light of 100 lamps. The air was thick with the smells of rich food, fresh lotus, incense, and perfume. Laughter, fed by 6 kinds of beer and 3 varieties of wine, pealed through the room, and the dancers leaped and twirled until they glistened with sweat and panted on the floor. A second troupe of musicians had been hired to supplement the local performers. This company sailed the river, stopping at temples and noble houses to play. But unlike the others, they refused to play with dancers on the floor, insisting that audiences attend to their songs, said to have magical qualities. The mysterious leader was a veiled lady. Blind, like many masters of the harp, she was mistress of the sistrum, the handheld bell drum. According to the gossip, the singer had escaped the jaws of Anubis and won a second life, but he had bitten off her face, which is why she wore the veil. The tale was told with a wink and a nudge, for Egyptians knew how a juicy story could be used to drum up business. Still, when the veiled singer was led into the room, an expectant hush fell, and the tipsy crowd sat up. She was dressed in white, covered head to toe in a gauzy stuff that floated in layers to the floor. Raynefer leaned toward me and whispered, "She looks like a puff of smoke." Settled on a stool, she freed her hands from her garments to take up the instrument, and the hush released a soft gasp, for her hands were as white as her robes, unearthly pale, as though scarred by a terrible fire. She shook the sistrum 4 times and produced 4 entirely different sounds, which sobered the listeners, who quieted to attention. First, the group played a light song of flutes and drums. Then a lone trumpet produced a mournful melody that caused the ladies to sigh and the men to stroke their chins. An old children's song made everyone in the room smile with the open faces they once wore as boys and girls. There was indeed magic to this music, which could transform the blackest sorrow to the brightest joy. The guests clapped their hands high in the direction of the performers and raised their cups in gratitude at Noctre for the wonderful entertainment. After the applause died down, the sistrum player began to sing, accompanied by her own instrument and a single drum. It was a long song, with many refrains. The story it told was unremarkable, a tale of love, found and lost, the oldest story in the world, the only story. As the song began, the man returned the girl's love, and they delighted in each other. But then the tale took a sorry turn, and the lover spurned his lady, leaving her alone. She wept and prayed to the golden lady Hathor, but to no avail. The beloved would not take her back. The girl's sorrow was endless and unbearable. The women wept openly, each remembering her youth. The men wiped their eyes, unashamed, recalling their earliest passion. Even the young one sighed, feeling the pangs of losses yet to come. There was a long silence after the song ended. The harpist picked out a quiet air, but the conversation ceased. No more cups were raised. Raynefer stood and left the room without ceremony, and then, one by one, the rest of the company took their leave. The party ended quietly, and the hall emptied to the sounds of sighs and murmured thanks. The musicians packed up their instruments and led their leader away. Some of the servants slept on the floor, too exhausted to begin cleaning up until morning. The house was completely still. Dawn was some hours distant when I found my way to where the musicians slept. The veiled one leaned against a wall, motionless. I thought she was sleeping as well, but she turned, her hands outstretched, to discover who approached. I put my hands in hers, which were small and cool. "Where in Roe?" I said. The sound of my accent startled her. "Kanan," she said in a bitter whisper. "That was my name in torment." "I was a child," I said. "You were the messenger of Rebecca, my grandmother. You told us a story I never forgot. But you were murdered, Warrenroe. I was there with the grandmother when they brought you back. I saw them bury your bones. Did you truly return from the dead?" There was a long silence, and her head fell forward beneath the veils. "Yes," she said. And then, after a moment, "No, I did not escape. The truth is, I am dead." How strange to find a ghost of that time here in a great house by the river. "Tell me," she asked, "are you dead too?" "Perhaps I am," I answered, shuddering. "Perhaps you are, for the living do not ask such questions, nor could they bear the pain of truth without the consolation of music. The dead understand." "Do you know the face of death?" she asked. "Yes," I said, remembering the dog-like shadows that attend so many births, patient and eager at the same time. "Ah," she said, and without warning lifted her veil. Her lips were unharmed, but the rest of her face was torn and scarred. Her nose had been broken and ripped open. Her cheeks were collapsed and seamed with deep scars. Her eyes were milky stones. It seemed impossible that anyone could survive such destruction. "I was leaving Tyre with a flagon of purple dye for her, for the grandmother. It was dawn, and the sky put all the tents of Mamre to shame. I was looking up when they came upon me. Three of them. Canaanite men, like any others, filthy and stupid. They said nothing to me or to each other. They took my pouch and my basket and ripped them open. And then they turned on me." Warrenroe began to rock back and forth, and her voice went flat. "The first one pushed me to the ground right in the middle of the road. The second one tore off my clothes. The third lifted his robe and fell upon me. He emptied himself into me, who had never laid with a man. And then he spit into my face. The second one took his turn, but he could not do the deed, and so he began to beat me, cursing me for causing his problem. He broke my nose and knocked several teeth from my mouth. And only when I was bleeding was he aroused enough to do what he wished. The third one turned me over and ripped me open from the backside and laughed." She stopped rocking and sat up straight, hearing that laughter still. I lay face down on the road as the three of them stood over me. I thought they would kill me and end my torment. But it was not for them. "Why do you not cry out?" cried the one who laughed. "Do you have no tongue? Or perhaps you are not really a woman at all, for you are not the color of woman. You are the color of a sick dog's shit. I will hear you cry out, and we will see if you are a woman or a phantom." And that is when they did to me what you can see. I need not speak of that. Werenro lowered her veil and began to rock again. "At the first sound of footsteps, they left me for dead," she said. "A shepherd's dog found me where I lay, followed by a boy, who cried out at the sight of me. I heard him retch and thought he would flee, but instead he covered me with his robe and brought his mother. She applied poultices to my face and unguents to my body, and stroked my hands in pity, and kept me alive, and never asked me to explain. When it was certain that I would survive, she asked whether she should send word to Mamre, for she had recognized the tatters of my robe. But I said no. I was finished being a slave, finished with Rebecca's arrogance, and finished with Canaan. My only desire was to come home and smell the river and the perfume of the lotus in the morning. I told her I wished to be dead in Mamre, and she made it so. She cut handfuls of my hair and wrapped it with my clothes and a few sheep's bones inside my bag. She sent her son into town, where he found a merchant headed for Mamre, who brought the grandmother news of my death. The Canaanite woman gave me a veil and a walking stick, and led me to Tyre. She searched out a caravan headed for the land of the great river. They took me in exchange for one of her flock, and for the promise that I would entertain them with songs and stories. The traders brought me to On, where a sistrum found its way into my hands. And now I find myself here with you, with Canaan in my mouth again. At this she turned her head away from me and spat. A snake slithered from the spot where her spittle fell, and I shivered in the cold blast of Werenro's anger. I would curse the whole nation but for that Canaanite woman's kindness. My eyes were put out, so I never saw her face, but I imagine it shining with light and beauty. Indeed, when I think of her, I see the face of the full moon. Perhaps she was atoning for some wrong she had done, or perhaps she had once been abandoned and someone helped her escape, or maybe no one had helped her when she was in need. She asked me nothing, not even my name. She saved me for no reason other than the goodness of her heart. Her name was goodness itself. Tamar, the sustaining fruit, said Werenro, and she began rocking again. We sat together in the hour before dawn, silent for a long while. Finally, she spoke again, to answer a question I would never have thought to ask. I am not unhappy, she said, nor am I content. There is nothing in my heart. I care for no one and for nothing. I dream of dogs with bared teeth. I am dead. It is not so bad to be dead. The sighs and snores of the sleeping musicians interrupted her words. Good souls, she said of her companions with tenderness, we ask nothing of one another. But you, said Werenro, how did you come to speak the language of the river? Without hesitation, I told her everything. I leaned my head back, closed my eyes, and gave voice to my life. In all of my years, I had never before spoken so much or so long. And yet the words came effortlessly, as though this were something I had done many times before. I surprised myself, remembering Tabia, remembering Rudy, remembering my coming of age in the red tent. I spoke of Shalem and our passionate lovemaking without blushing. I spoke of our betrayal and his murder. I told her about Raynefer's bargain with me and Merritt's care for me, and I spoke of my son with pride and love. It was not difficult. Indeed, it was as though I had been parched, and there was cool water in my mouth. I said Shalem, and my breath was clean after years of being foul and bitter. I called my son Bar Shalem, and an old tightness in my chest eased. I recited the names of my mothers, and knew with total certainty that they were dead. I leaned my face into Werenro's shoulder and soaked her robe in memory of Leah and Rachel, Zilpah and Bilhah. Through it all, Werenro nodded and sighed and held my hand. When at last I was quiet, she said, "You are not dead." Her voice betrayed a little sorrow. "You are not like me. Your grief shines from your heart. The flame of love is strong. Your story is not finished, Dina," she said, in the accents of my mother's. Not Dina, the foreign midwife, but Dina, a daughter beloved of four mothers. Warren Rose stroked my head, which rested on her shoulder, as the room began to brighten with the first hints of dawn. I fell asleep leaning there, but when I awoke, she was gone. Ramos left a week later, in the company of Carr, who arrived from Memphis on his way to Kush. Ramos brought the venerable master into the garden to introduce us, but he barely acknowledged the low-born mother of his favorite student. After they left, I wondered, without pity, whether the old man would survive such a long journey. Chapter 3. Benia had delivered the box as he had said he would, but I was not there to receive it. When he brought it to the garden gate, he was brusquely told that Diener was sitting in the great hall with her son and could not be called away by a tradesman. The box was placed in a corner of the kitchen, and I did not see it until after Ramos had left Thebes and the house had returned to normal. When the cook gave it to me, her curiosity overwhelmed her. How had something so elegant and rare come to be mine? And who was the man who asked after me so eagerly? I said nothing of him or the box to anyone in the house, and the gossip soon died away. I sent no word to Benia either, hoping he would take my silence as a rejection of the indirect offer he had made me in the marketplace. Although I had been moved by his words and by his touch, I could not see myself living like other women. Despite Warren Rose's words, I was sure that Ramos would tell the next and final chapters of my story. Merritt was furious at me for turning Benia down. A man like that? So accomplished? So kind? She threatened never to speak to me again, but we both knew that could never happen. I was her daughter, and she would never cut me off. But Benia's box remained an embarrassment and a reproach to me. It did not belong in a garden shed. It was not made for a foreign-born midwife without status or standing. It was mine only because the carpenter had recognized my loneliness, and because I had seen the need in him, too. I filled the box with gifts from my mother's, but covered its gleaming beauty with an old papyrus mat so that it would not remind me of Benia, whom I resigned to the corner of my heart with other dreams that had died. The weeks flowed quietly into months, the passage of time marked by the stories of births, most of them healthy. I learned that a tonic made of the red matter growing in my garden eased childbirth for many, and Merritt and I were called to ever more distant neighborhoods. Once a bark was sent to bring us to the town of On, where a priest's favorite concubine lay dying. We found a girl far too young to be a mother, screaming in terror, alone in a room without the comfort of another woman. Shortly after we arrived, we closed her eyes and I tried to free the baby, but she too was dead. Merritt went to speak to the father, who, far from bereaved, began to curse my friend and me for killing his wife and child. He rushed into the birthing chamber before I had time to cover the poor mother. "The foreigner raised a knife to her?" he shrieked. "Only a surgeon can do such a thing. This woman is a menace, a demon sent from the east to destroy the kingdom of the river." He lunged at me, but Merritt stopped him, and with strength I did not know she possessed, pinned him against a wall and tried to explain that I had cut the mother in hope of saving the child. But I saw no reason to explain myself. I looked into his eyes and saw an odious and petty soul, and I was filled with rage and pity for the young woman who lay at my feet. "Pervert," I roared in the language of my mother's, "foul son of a maggot, may you and others like you wither like wheat in the desert. This was an unloved girl who lies here dead. The stench of her unhappiness clings to her. For this, you will die in agony. Both Merritt and the priest stared at me as I spewed out my curses, and when I was finished, the man began to shudder and in a terrified whisper said, "A foreign sorceress in the house of the gods!" The sound of our voices had drawn other priests, who did not meet my eyes, and held their brother so we could leave. On the journey back, I watched the shoreline pass and remembered Inna's prophecy that I would find my heart's desire by the banks of a river. I shook my head over the irony of her vision and returned to my garden shed, unsettled and discontented. For the first time since my childhood, I was restless. I no longer dreamed of Shalem or his death, but woke up every morning haunted by visions of deserted landscapes, gaunt sheep, wailing women. I rose from my pallet, vainly trying to name my disquiet. Merritt noticed gray hairs on my head and offered to make me a dye of ash and the blood of a black ox. I laughed at the idea, although I knew she used the potion and looked far younger than her years because of it. Her suggestion made me view my restlessness as nothing more than a sign of the passing years. I was nearly of the age when women stop bleeding at the new moon, and I pictured myself passing the twilight of my days in the familiar peace of Noctre's garden. I set a statue of Isis over my bed and prayed for the wisdom and tranquility of the Lady Goddess, healer of women and men. But I neglected to pray for the well-being of my earthly protectors. Late one night, I was awakened by the sound of howling cats, and the next morning, Noctre came to tell me that Rhaenefer had died in her sleep. Her body was collected by priests, who would prepare her body for the next life with elaborate ritual in her father's tomb in Memphis, where a statue had been prepared in her memory. The rites would last for 3 days. Noctre asked if I would like to attend the ritual with him. I thanked him, but said no. He must have been relieved, for we both knew that there was no comfortable place for me among the celebrants. In the days after Rhaenefer's death, I cursed her as much as I wept for her. She had been my savior and my jailer. She had given me Shalem, and then stolen his memory. Finally, I did not know the woman at all. I had seen little of her since Ramos had gone to school, and had no idea how she kept busy all those years, if she spun or wove, if she slept the days away, if she wept at night for her son and her husband, if she hated me, or pitied me, or loved me. I dreamed in vivid detail in the nights following her death, and Rhaenefer visited me in the form of a small bird flying out of the sunrise, screaming Shehem in a familiar voice I could not name. The Rhaenefer bird tried to lift people and objects from the ground, but had no strength, and beat her wings in frustration until she was exhausted and furious. Every night she disappeared into the sun, shrieking. It seemed her troubled soul would never find peace. After 7 nights of that vision, I felt nothing but pity for her. Noctre died the following season, and for him I mourned without reservation. Honest, generous, good-humored, and always kind, he was the model of an Egyptian nobleman. My son was blessed to have had such a father, and I knew Ramos would weep for the only Ba he had ever known. I assumed that Ramos went to Memphis for the rites, though I was not told. Only Noctre had thought to tell me about my son's travels. With his death, I felt my connection to Ramos weaken. After Noctre was gone, his wife went to live with her brother somewhere north in the Delta. The house would be given to a new scribe. Had Ramos been a little older and more practiced in the politics of the temple, he might have been given the position. Instead, one of Noctre's rivals was chosen. Most of the staff would remain, and the cook urged me to stay on too. But the chill in the eyes of the new mistress who came to survey what was to be her home made me want nothing less. Merritt, too, was facing a change. Her older son, Menna, had offered her a place under his roof in the Valley of the Kings. He had been appointed chief baker and given a larger house where his mother was welcome. Menna made the journey to see his mother and said that though many babies were born to the wives of craftsmen in the valley, there were no skilled midwives and many women had died. Merritt would be an honored citizen if she came to live among them. My friend was tempted. Since the disastrous journey to On, rumors had begun to circulate about the foreign-born midwife and her companion. The priest I had cursed had lost the use of his voice after I saw him, and then he went lame. There were fewer calls to attend at the births of noblewomen, though their servants and the tradesmen's wives still sought us out. I knew that my friend relished the thought of honor and a new start, but she worried about living with a daughter-in-law and fretted about giving up the comforts of life in Thebes. She told her son that she would weigh his invitation until the following season, when the new year began. After all, she explained to me, the appearance of the dog star marked the most auspicious time for making changes. My friend and I weighed our choices, but we often fell silent, keeping our worst fears to ourselves. In truth, I had nowhere to go. Hurja had not offered me a place with her. I would simply have to stay where I was and hope for the best. If Merritt left for her son's house, loneliness would swallow me. But I kept still about that and listened as she described life in the valley. Merritt never considered leaving without me, but she worried about asking her daughter-in-law to put up with two women in her house. My friend presented her dilemma to her good mistress, and Rudadit begged her to stay and gave her word that I, too, would always have a place under her roof. But the lady's husband was nothing like Noctre. He was a narrow-minded tyrant, with a temper that sometimes broke upon the backs of his servants, and even Rudadit kept her distance from him. My life would be pinched and furtive if I went to that house. I might have lost heart, except for the consolation I found in my dreams, where a garden of 1,000 lotuses bloomed, children laughed, and strong arms held me safe. Merritt put great store in these dreams and visited a local oracle who foresaw love and riches for me in the steaming entrails of a goat. The new year came, and Menna returned to see his mother. His wife, Shifre, accompanied him this time and said, "Mother, come home with us. My sons work with their father in the bakery all day, and I am often alone in the house. There is plenty of room for you to sit in the sun and rest. Or if you wish to continue as a midwife, I will carry your kit and become your assistant. You will be honored in my husband's house, and after your death, we will honor your memory with a fine steel with your name on the west side." Merritt was moved by her daughter-in-law's speech. Shifre was a few years younger than I, a plain woman, except for her eyes, which were large and ringed with thick black lashes and radiated compassion. "Menna is lucky in you," said Merritt, taking the woman's hands in hers. "But I cannot leave Dinar here. She is my daughter now, and without me, she is alone in the world. In truth, she is the master midwife, and I am her assistant. It is she the women of royal Thebes call for when their time is at hand. I cannot ask you to take her in. And yet, if you offer her the same hospitality, I believe you will be well rewarded in this life. She carries the mark of money and luck. She dreams with great power and sees through lies. All of this has rubbed off on me, and it will benefit you and your house, too." Shifre went to her husband with Merritt's words. Menna was not pleased at the prospect of yet another aging woman in his house, but the promise of luck struck a chord with him. He came with his mother and wife to my shed to make me welcome, and I accepted his offer with genuine gratitude. I took a turquoise scarab from my box and gave it to Menna. Hospitality is the God's own treasure, I said, placing my forehead to the ground before the baker, who was embarrassed to be shown such obeisance. Perhaps my brother can give you his garden for your own, he said, helping me to my feet. His wife has no knack with growing things, and my mother tells me you have Osiris's own touch with the soil. Then it was my turn to be embarrassed at his kindness. How had I come to find so many kind people in my life? What was the purpose of such good fortune? Mena's work called him home, so we had only a few days to prepare for our journey. First, I went to the marketplace and hired a scribe who wrote on behalf of unlettered people, and through him sent word to Ramos, assistant to Kar the scribe, residing in Kush, to inform him that his mother, Diner, had moved to the Valley of the Kings, to the house of the chief baker called Mena. I sent him blessings in the name of Isis and her son Horus, and I paid the scribe double his fee to make sure the message would find my son. I gathered the herbs of my garden, taking cuttings of roots as well as dried plants. As I worked, I remembered how my mothers stripped their garden before leaving one life for another. I ventured into the market by myself and traded most of my trinkets for olive oil and castor oil, for juniper oil and berries, for I heard that few trees thrived in the valley. I scoured the stalls for the finest knife I could find, and the day before we left, Merritt and I went to the river and collected reeds enough to deliver 1,000 babies. I packed what I owned inside Benny's box, which had grown even more beautiful as the wood mellowed with age. Closing the lid, I tasted relief at my escape from an unhappy future. The night before I left the house of Noctre, I kept watch in the garden, walking around the pool, running my fingers over every bush and tree, filling my nose with the rich smells of blooming lotus and fresh clover. When the moon began to set, I crept inside the house and wandered past sleeping bodies up to the roof. The cats rubbed up against me, and I smiled, remembering my first fright at seeing the fur snakes of the land. All of my days in Egypt had been spent in that house, and looking back on them in the night air, I recalled little but good. The scent of my infant son, and the face of Noctre, cucumbers and honeyed fish, Merritt's laughter, and the smiles of the new mothers to whom I delivered healthy sons and daughters. The painful things, Werenro's story, Rhaenyra's choice, even my own loneliness, seemed like the knots on a beautiful necklace, necessary for keeping the beads in place. My eyes filled as I bade farewell to those days, but I felt no regret. I was sitting outside the garden door, my box and a small bundle beside me, when the others arrived in the morning. Rudadit walked with us as far as the ferry and embraced me before I got on the boat. She wept into Merritt's arms for a long while, but she was the only one weeping as the ferry pulled away from shore. I waved at her once, but then I set my eyes to the west. The journey from the house of the scribe to the house of the baker took only one day, but the passage measured the difference between two worlds. The ferry was crowded with valley residents in a gala mood, on their way home from market. Many of the men had paid for the ministrations of open-air barbers, so their cheeks gleamed and their hair glistened. Mothers chatted about the children at their sides, petting them and scolding them in turn. Strangers struck up conversations with one another, comparing purchases and trying to establish a connection by comparing family names, occupations, and addresses. They seemed always to find a common friend or ancestor, and then clapped one another on the back like long-lost brothers. They were at ease with themselves and one another like no other people I had ever seen, and I wondered what made it so. Perhaps it was because there were no lords or guards on the boat, not even a scribe. Only craftsmen and their families heading home. After the ferry, there was a short, steep climb to the town, which sprawled in the entrance to the valley like a giant wasp nest. My heart fell. It was as ugly a place as I'd ever seen. In the searing heat of the afternoon sun, the trees along the deserted streets looked limp and dirty. Houses crowded together, side by side, by the hundreds, each one as unremarkable and drab as the next. The doorways led down off the narrow pathways into darkness, and I wondered if I would be too tall to stand erect in the largest of them. The streets gave no hint of gardens or colors or any of the good things in life. Somehow, Mena recognized one street from another and led us to the doorway of his brother's house, where a small boy stood watching. When he saw us, he shouted for his father, and Merritt's second son, Hori, rushed into the street, both hands filled with fresh bread. He ran to Merritt and lifted her up by the elbows, swinging her around and around, smiling with Merritt's own smile. His family gathered and clapped their hands as their grandmother laughed into her son's face and kissed him on the nose. Hori still had a house full of children, five in all, ranging from a marriageable daughter to the naked toddler who first spied us. The family spilled into the street, drawing neighbors to the doorways where they smiled at the commotion. Then Merritt was led through the antechamber of Hori's house and into his hall, a modest room where high windows let in the afternoon light on brightly colored floor mats and walls painted with a lush garden scene. My friend was seated on the best chair of the house and formally introduced, one by one, to her grandchildren. I sat on the floor against a wall, watching Merritt bask in the glory of her children. The women brought food in from the back rooms, where I caught sight of a kitchen garden. Merritt praised the food, which was well spiced and plentiful, and declared the beer better than any she had tasted in the city of the nobles. Her daughter-in-law beamed at those words, and her son nodded with pride. The children stared at me, having never seen a woman quite so tall, or a face so obviously foreign. They kept their distance, except for the little sentinel, who clambered up on my lap and stayed there, his thumb in his mouth. The weight of a child on my chest reminded me of the sweetness of the days I held Ramos so. Forgetting myself, I sighed with such longing, the others turned toward me. "My friend," cried Merritt, who rushed over to my side, "forgive me for forgetting you." The child's mother came and took him from me, and Merritt drew me to my feet. "This is Diener," she announced, and turned me around like a child so that everyone would see my face. "Mena will tell you that she is a friendless midwife he has taken in out of compassion. But I tell you that I am her friend and her sister, and that I am her student, for I have never seen nor heard tell of a more skilled midwife. She has Isis's hands, and with a goddess's love of children, shows the compassion of heaven for mothers and babies." Merritt, her cheeks flushed with the attentions of her family, spoke about me like a merchant in the marketplace selling her wares. "And she is an oracle too, my dears. Her dreams are powerful, and her anger is to be feared, for I have seen her blast an evil man out of the prime of his life for harming a young mother. She sees clearly into the hearts of men, and none fool her with fine words that conceal a lying heart." "She comes from the east," said Merritt, now intoxicated with the sound of her own voice and her children's attention. "There, women are often as tall as the men of Egypt, and our Diener is as clever as she is tall, for she speaks both the language of the East and our tongue. And she gave birth to Ramos, a scribe, the heir of Noctre, who will someday be a power in the land. We are lucky to have his mother among us, and the house of Mena will find itself lucky when she sleeps under his roof." I was mortified to have so many eyes upon me. "Thanks," was all I could say. "Thank you," I said, bowing to Mena and Shifre, and then to Hori and his wife Takaru. "Thank you for your generosity. I am your servant in gratitude." I returned to my corner by the wall, content to observe the family as they ate and joked and enjoyed one another. As the light began to fade, I closed my eyes for a moment and saw Rachel holding Joseph on her lap, her cheek pressed against his. I had not thought of my brother Joseph for years, and I could not place the memory exactly. But the scene was as vivid as my recollections of Leah's touch, as clear in my mind's eye as the tents of Mamre. Even as a child, I knew that Joseph would be the one to carry the family story into the next generation. He would be the one to change into someone more interesting and complicated than simply a beautiful man born of a beautiful mother. Merritt's family thought I napped as I sat by the wall, but I was lost in thoughts of Joseph and Rachel, Leah and Jacob, my aunties and Inna and the days before Shechem. I sighed again, the sigh of an orphan, and my breath filled the room with a momentary melancholy that announced the end of the welcoming party. Night was falling as Menna led Merritt and me through the moonlit streets to his house, which was nearby. Although it was larger and even better appointed than Hori's, it was hot and airless inside, so we carried our pallets up a ladder to the roof, where the canopy of stars seemed only a handbreadth away. I woke just before sunrise and stood up to see the entire town dreaming. They lay alone or in pairs, or in clusters with children and dogs. A cat walked down the street below, carrying something in her mouth. She placed it on the ground, and I saw it was a kitten, whom she began to lick clean. As I watched, the sun turned the cliffs pink and then gold. Women stirred and stretched, and then climbed down the ladders. Soon, the smell of food filled the air, and the day began. At first, Shifrei would not permit me or Merritt to do anything in her kitchen or garden, so the two of us sat useless, watching her work. Merritt had a horror of becoming a meddling mother-in-law, but her hands ached to be busy. "Only let me press out the beer," she asked. "I could sweep the roof," I proposed, but Shifrei seemed insulted by our offers. After a week of sitting, I could bear it no longer. Picking up a large empty jug, I announced, "I'm going to the fountain," and walked out the door before my hostess could object, surprising myself as well as Merritt. After years of fearing the street in Thebes, I rushed into this one, not entirely sure of where to go. But since there were always other women on their way to and from the fountain, I quickly discovered my route. As I walked, I peered into doorways and smiled at naked children playing in the dust. I began to see differences between one house and the next. Flowers planted here and there, lintels painted red or green, stools set up by the doorways. I felt like a girl again, my eyes open to new scenes, my day empty of work. Near the fountain, I overtook a pregnant woman waddling in front of me. "This is not your first, is it?" I asked brightly as I reached her side. When she spun around to look at me, I saw Rachel's face as it must have appeared in the long years before Joseph was finally born to her. The woman's face twisted in anger and desperation. "Oh, my dear," I said, ashamed. "I spoke before I understood what this means to you. Fear not, little mother. This boy will be fine." Her eyes widened with fear and hope, and her mouth dropped wide. "How dare you speak to me so? This one will die like the others before. I am hated by the gods." Bitterness and anguish